In 1948, I woke up one morning to read in the New York Times that Street & Smith Publications had discontinued all its pulp magazines. Since Astounding Science Fiction was one of the Street & Smith pulps, everything went black before my eyes. You see, during the six-year period from 1943 to 1948 inclusive, I had sold and published 13 science fiction stories, every single one of them to Astounding. During that period, I had labored constantly with the feeling that I was not a writer at all, but merely a person who happened to click it off with one particular market, and that if anything happened to Astounding or to Mr. Campbell, its editor, I was through. With great difficulty, I finished the article and found, near the end, the utterly casual statement, almost as an afterthought, that Astounding was the one exception. It was the only pulp magazine Street & Smith was going to retain. I was retrieved, but I still felt in a most fragile situation. Something might still happen to either Astounding or to Mr. Campbell. Nothing did, at least so far. At this moment of writing, more than 20 years after that article, Astounding still flourishes, although it has a different publisher and has changed its name to Analog, and the durable Mr. Campbell is still its editor. I sold 4 more stories to Astounding in 1949 and 1950 before breaking the string. Then in 1950, a new science fiction magazine came into sudden, vigorous life under the energetic leadership of its editor, Horace L. Gold. Mr. Gold searched strenuously for stories while the new magazine was being formed, and he asked me if I would submit some. I hesitated, for I was not at all sure that Mr. Gold would like them, and I was wondering whether I could bear rejections that would serve as proof that I was not a real writer, but only a one-editor author. Mr. Gold was, however, persuasive. I wrote 2 stories, and he took them both. The first story, I felt, might have been a forced sale. He needed it for the maiden issue in a big hurry. The second story, which appeared in the second issue, did not have to be bought, it seemed to me. I accepted the sale as deserved, and a more than 7-year agony of self-doubt was relieved. It is this second story which follows. But one thing, editors have the frequent urge to change the titles of stories, heaven knows why. Some editors have it worse than others, and Mr. Gold had a rather acute case. My own title for this story was Green Patches, for reasons that will seem perfectly clear when you read the story. For some obscure reason, Mr. Gold didn't like it, and when the story appeared, it bore the name Misbegotten Missionary. Except for the alliteration, I could see no reason why this new title should appeal to any rational person. So I am seizing the opportunity now to change the title back to what it had been. I don't think I'm being unduly hasty in doing so. I have been waiting 18 years for a chance. First appearance, Galaxy Science Fiction, November 1950, under the title Misbegotten Missionary. Copyright 1950 by World Editions, Incorporated. Green Patches. He had slipped aboard the ship. There had been dozens waiting outside the energy barrier when it had seemed that waiting would do no good. Then the barrier had faltered for a matter of 2 minutes, which showed the superiority of unified organisms over life fragments, and he was across. None of the others had been able to move quickly enough to take advantage of the break, but that didn't matter. All alone, he was enough. No others were necessary. And the thought faded out of satisfaction and into loneliness. It was a terribly unhappy and unnatural thing to be parted from all the rest of the unified organism, to be a life fragment oneself. How could these aliens stand being fragments? It increased his sympathy for the aliens. Now that he experienced fragmentation himself, he could feel, as though from a distance, the terrible isolation that made them so afraid. It was fear born of that isolation that dictated their actions. What but the insane fear of their condition could have caused them to blast an area 1 mile in diameter into dull red heat before landing their ship? Even the organized life 10 feet deep in the soil had been destroyed in the blast. He engaged reception, listening eagerly, letting the alien thought saturate him. He enjoyed the touch of life upon his consciousness. He would have to ration that enjoyment. He must not forget himself. But it could do no harm to listen to thoughts. Some of the fragments of life on the ship thought quite clearly, considering that they were such primitive, incomplete creatures. Their thoughts were like tiny bells. Roger Olden said, "I feel contaminated, you know what I mean? I keep washing my hands and it doesn't help." Jerry Thorne hated dramatics and didn't look up. They were still maneuvering in the stratosphere of Saybrook's planet, and he preferred to watch the panel dials. He said, "No reason to feel contaminated. Nothing happened." "I hope not," said Alden. "At least they had all the field men discard their spacesuits in the airlock for complete disinfection. They had a radiation bath for all men entering from outside. I suppose nothing happened. Why be nervous, then?" "I don't know. I wish the barrier hadn't broken down." "Who doesn't? It was an accident. I wonder." Alden was vehement. "I was here when it happened. My shift, you know. There was no reason to overload the power line. There was equipment plugged into it that had no damn business near it, none whatsoever." "All right, people are stupid." "Not that stupid. I hung around when the old man was checking into the matter. None of them had reasonable excuses. The armor baking circuits, which were draining off 2,000 watts, had been put into the barrier line. They'd been using the second subsidiaries for a week. Why not this time? They couldn't give any reason." "Can you?" Alden flushed. "No. I was just wondering if the man had been," he searched for a word, "hypnotized into it by those things outside." Thorne's eyes lifted and met those of the other levelly. "I wouldn't repeat that to anyone else. The barrier was down only 2 minutes. If anything had happened, if even a spear of grass had drifted across, it would have shown up in our bacteria cultures within half an hour. In the fruit fly colonies, in a matter of days. Before we got back, it would show up in the hamsters, the rabbits, maybe the goats. Just get it through your head, Alden, that nothing happened. Nothing." Alden turned on his heel and left. In leaving, his foot came within 2 feet of the object in the corner of the room. He did not see it. He disengaged his reception centers and let the thoughts flow past him unperceived. These life fragments were not important in any case, since they were not fitted for the continuation of life. Even as fragments, they were incomplete. The other types of fragments now, they were different. He had to be careful of them. The temptation would be great, and he must give no indication, none at all, of his existence on board ship till they landed on their home planet. He focused on the other parts of the ship, marveling at the diversity of life. Each item, no matter how small, was sufficient to itself. He forced himself to contemplate this until the unpleasantness of the thought grated on him and he longed for the normality of home. Most of the thoughts he received from these smaller fragments were vague and fleeting, as you would expect. There wasn't much to be had from them, but that meant their need for completeness was all the greater. It was that which touched him so keenly. There was the life fragment which squatted on its haunches and fingered the wire netting that enclosed it. Its thoughts were clear but limited. Chiefly, they concerned the yellow fruit a companion fragment was eating. It wanted the fruit very deeply. Only the wire netting that separated the fragments prevented its seizing the fruit by force. He disengaged reception in a moment of complete revulsion. These fragments competed for food. He tried to reach far outward for the peace and harmony of home, but he was already an immense distance away. He could reach only into the nothingness that separated him from sanity. He longed at the moment even for the feel of the dead soil between the barrier and the ship. He had crawled over it last night. There had been no life upon it, but it had been the soil of home, and on the other side of the barrier there had still been the comforting feel of the rest of organized life. He could remember the moment he had located himself on the surface of the ship, maintaining a desperate suction grip until the airlock opened. He had entered, moving cautiously between the outgoing feet. There had been an inner lock, and that had been passed later. Now he lay here, a life fragment himself, inert and unnoticed. Cautiously, he engaged reception again at the previous focus. The squatting fragment of life was tugging furiously at the wire netting. It still wanted the other's food, though it was the less hungry of the two. Larson said, "Don't feed the damn thing. She isn't hungry. She's just sore because Tilly had the nerve to eat before she herself was crammed full. The greedy ape. I wish we were back home and I never had to look another animal in the face again." He scowled at the older female chimpanzee frowningly, and the chimp mouthed and chattered back to him in full reciprocation. Rizzo said, Okay, why hang around here then? Feeding time is over. Let's get out." They went past the goat pens, the rabbit hutches, the hamster cages. Larson said bitterly, "You volunteer for an exploration voyage. You're a hero. They send you off with speeches and make a zookeeper out of you." "They give you double pay." "All right, so what? I didn't sign up just for the money. They said at the original briefing that it was even odds we wouldn't come back. that we'd end up like Saybrook. I signed up because I wanted to do something important. Just a bloomin' bloody hero, said Rizzo. I'm not an animal nurse. Rizzo paused to lift a hamster out of the cage and stroke it. Hey, he said, did you ever think that maybe one of these hamsters has some cute little baby hamsters inside just getting started? Wise guy, they're tested every day. Sure, sure. He muzzled the little creature, which vibrated its nose at him. But just suppose you came down one morning and found them there. New little hamsters looking up at you with soft, green patches of fur where the eyes ought to be. Shut up, for the love of Mike, yelled Larson. Little soft, green patches of shining fur, said Rizzo, and put the hamster down with a sudden loathing sensation. He engaged reception again and varied the focus. There wasn't a specialized life fragment at home that didn't have a rough counterpart on shipboard. And there were the moving runners in various shapes, the moving swimmers and the moving flyers. Some of the flyers were quite large with perceptible thoughts. Others were small, gauzy-winged creatures. These last transmitted only patterns of sense perception, imperfect patterns at that, and added nothing intelligent of their own. And there were the non-movers, which, like the non-movers at home, were green and lived on the air, water, and soil. These were a mental blank. They knew only the dim, dim consciousness of light, moisture, and gravity. And each fragment, moving and non-moving, had its mockery of life. Not yet. Not yet. He clamped down hard upon his feelings. Once before, these life fragments had come, and the rest at home had tried to help them too quickly. It had not worked. This time they must wait. If only these fragments did not discover him. They had not so far. They had not noticed him lying in the corner of the pilot room. No one had bent down to pick up and discard him. Earlier, it had meant he could not move. Someone might have turned and stared at the stiff, worm-like thing not quite 6 inches long. First stare, then shout, and then it would all be over. But now, perhaps he had waited long enough. The takeoff was long past. The controls were locked. The pilot room was empty. It did not take him long to find the chink in the armor leading to the recess where some of the wiring was. They were dead wires. The front end of his body was a rasp that cut in two a wire of just the right diameter. Then, 6 inches away, he cut it in two again. He pushed the snipped-off section of the wire ahead of him, packing it away neatly and invisibly into a corner of recess. Its outer covering was a brown, elastic material, and its core was gleaming ruddy metal. He himself could not reproduce the core, of course, but that was not necessary. It was enough that the pellicle that covered him had been carefully bred to resemble a wire's surface. He returned and grasped the cut sections of the wire before and behind. He tightened against them as his little suction discs came into play. Not even a seam showed. They could not find him now. They could look right at him and see only a continuous stretch of wire, unless they looked very closely indeed and noted that in a certain spot on this wire there were two tiny patches of soft and shining green fur. It is remarkable, said Dr. Weiss, that little green hairs can do so much. Captain Loring poured the brandy carefully. In a sense, this was a celebration. They would be ready for the jump through hyperspace in 2 hours, and after that, 2 days would see them back on Earth. You are convinced, then, the green fur is the sense organ? He asked. It is, said Weiss. Brandy made him come out in splotches, but he was aware of the need of celebration, quite aware. The experiments were conducted under difficulties, but they were quite significant. The captain smiled stiffly. Under difficulties is one way of phrasing it. I would never have taken the chances you did to run them. Nonsense! We're all heroes aboard this ship, all volunteers, all great men with trumpet, fife, and fanfarade. You took the chance of coming here. You were the first to go outside the barrier. No particular risk involved, Weiss said. I burned the ground before me as I went, to say nothing of the portable barrier that surrounded me. Nonsense, Captain. Let's all take our medals when we come back. Let's take them without attempt at gradation. Besides, I'm a male. But you're filled with bacteria to here, the captain's hand made a quick cutting gesture 3 inches above his head, which makes you as vulnerable as a female would be. They paused for drinking purposes. Refill? Asked the captain. No, thanks. I've exceeded my quota already. Then one last for the space route. He lifted his glass in the general direction of Saybrook's planet, no longer visible, its sun only a bright star in the visiplate. To the little green hairs that gave Saybrook his first lead. Weiss nodded. A lucky thing. We'll quarantine the planet, of course. The captain said, That doesn't seem drastic enough. Someone might always land by accident someday and not have Saybrook's inside or his guts. Suppose he did not blow up his ship as Saybrook did. Suppose he got back to some inhabited place. The captain was somber. Do you suppose they might ever develop interstellar travel on their own? I doubt it. No proof, of course. It's just that they have such a completely different orientation. Their entire organization of life has made tools unnecessary. As far as we know, even a stone axe doesn't exist on the planet. I hope you're right. Oh, and Weiss, would you spend some time with Drake? The Galactic Press fella? Yes. Once we get back, the story of Saybrook's planet will be released for the public, and I don't think it would be wise to over-sensationalize it. I've asked Drake to let you consult with him on the story. You're a biologist and enough of an authority to carry weight with him. Would you oblige? A pleasure. The captain closed his eyes wearily and shook his head. Headache, Captain? No. Just thinking of poor Saybrook. He was weary of the ship. A while back, there had been a queer momentary sensation, as though he had been turned inside out. It was alarming, and he had searched the minds of the keen thinkers for an explanation. Apparently, the ship had leaped across vast stretches of empty space by cutting across something they knew as hyperspace. The keen thinkers were ingenious, but he was weary of the ship. It was such a futile phenomenon. These life fragments were skillful in their constructions, yet it was only a measure of their unhappiness, after all. They strove to find in the control of inanimate matter what they could not find in themselves. In their unconscious yearning for completeness, they built machines and scoured space, seeking. These creatures, he knew, could never, in the very nature of things, find that for which they were seeking. At least not until such time as he gave it to them. He quivered a little at the thought. Completeness. These fragments had no concept of it, even. Completeness was a poor word. In their ignorance, they would even fight it. There had been the ship that had come before. The first ship had contained many of the keen-thinking fragments. There had been two varieties, life-producers and the sterile ones. How different this second ship was. The keen-thinkers were all sterile, while the other fragments, the fuzzy-thinkers and the no-thinkers, were all producers of life. It was strange. How gladly that first ship had been welcomed by all the planet. He could remember the first intense shock at the realization that the visitors were fragments and not complete. The shock had given way to pity, and the pity to action. It was not certain how they would fit into the community, but there had been no hesitation. All life was sacred, and somehow room would have been made for them, for all of them, from the large keen thinkers to the little multipliers in the darkness. But there had been a miscalculation. They had not correctly analyzed the course of the fragment's ways of thinking. The keen thinkers became aware of what had been done and resented it. They were frightened, of course. They did not understand. They had developed the barrier first, and then, later, had destroyed themselves, exploding their ships to atoms. Poor, foolish fragments. This time, at least, it would be different. They would be saved despite themselves. John Drake would not have admitted it in so many words, but he was very proud of his skill on the phototyper. He had a travel kit model, which was a 6x8 featureless dark plastic slab with cylindrical bulges on either end to hold the roll of thin paper. It fitted into a brown leather case equipped with a belt-like contraption that held it closely about the waist and at one hip. The whole thing weighed less than a pound. Drake could operate it with either hand. His fingers would flick quickly and easily, placing their light pressure at exact spots on the blank surface, and soundlessly, words would be written. He looked thoughtfully at the beginning of his story, then up at Dr. Weiss. What do you think, Doc? It starts well. Drake nodded. I thought I might as well start with Saybrook himself. They haven't released his story back home yet. I wish I could have seen Saybrook's original report. How did he ever get it through, by the way? As near as I could tell, he spent one last night sending it through the sub-ether. When he was finished, he shorted the motors and converted the entire ship into a thin cloud of vapor a millionth of a second later, the crew and himself along with it.
What a man. You were in this from the beginning, Doc?
Not from the beginning, corrected Weiss gently, only since the receipt of Saybrook's report. He could not help thinking back. He had read that report, realizing even then how wonderful the planet must have seemed when Saybrook's colonizing expedition first reached it. It was practically a duplicate of Earth, with an abounding plant life and a purely vegetarian animal life. There had been only the little patches of green fur. How often had he used that phrase in his speaking and thinking, which seemed strange. No living individual on the planet had eyes. Instead, there was this fur. Even the plants, each blade or leaf or blossom, possessed the two patches of richer green. Then Saybrook had noticed, startled and bewildered, that there was no conflict for food on the planet. All plants grew pulpy appendages which were eaten by the animals. These were regrown in a matter of hours. No other parts of the plant were touched. It was as though the plants fed the animals as part of the order of nature, and the plants themselves did not grow in overpowering profusion. They might almost have been cultivated. They were spread across the available soil so discriminately. How much time, Weiss wondered, had Saybrook had to observe the strange law and order on the planet, the fact that insects kept their numbers reasonable, though no birds ate them, that the rodent-like things did not swarm, though no carnivores existed to keep them in check. And then there had come the incident of the white rats. That prodded Weiss. He said, "Oh, one correction, Drake. Hamsters were not the first animals involved. It was the white rats." "White rats," said Drake, making the correction in his notes. "Every colonizing ship," said Weiss, "takes a group of white rats for the purpose of testing any alien foods. Rats, of course, are very similar to human beings from a nutritional viewpoint. Naturally, only female white rats are taken." Naturally. If only one sex was present, there was no danger of unchecked multiplication in case the planet proved favorable. Remember the rabbits in Australia. "Incidentally, why not use males?" asked Drake. "Females are hardier," said Weiss, "which is lucky, since that gave the situation away. It turned out suddenly that all the rats were bearing young." "Right. Now, that's where I'm up to, so here's my chance to get some things straight. For my own information, Doc, how did Saybrook find out they were in a family way?" "Accidentally, of course. In the course of nutritional investigations, rats are dissected for evidence of internal damage. Their condition was bound to be discovered. A few more were dissected, same results. Eventually, all that lived gave birth to young, with no male rats aboard." "And the point is that all the young were born with little green patches of fur instead of eyes." "That is correct. Saybrook said so, and we corroborate him. After the rats, the pet cat of one of the children was obviously affected. When it finally kittened, the kittens were not born with closed eyes, but with little patches of green fur. There was no tomcat aboard. Eventually, Saybrook had the women tested. He didn't tell them what for. He didn't want to frighten them. Every single one of them was in the early stages of pregnancy, leaving out of consideration those few who had been pregnant at the time of embarkation. Saybrook never waited for any child to be born, of course. He knew they would have no eyes, only shining patches of green fur. He even prepared bacterial cultures. Saybrook was a thorough man and found each bacillus to show microscopic green spots." Drake was eager. "That goes way beyond our briefing, or at least the briefing I got. But granted that life on Saybrook's planet is organized into a unified whole, how is it done?" "How? How are your cells organized into a unified whole? Take an individual cell out of your body, even a brain cell, and what is it by itself? Nothing. A little blob of protoplasm with no more capacity for anything human than an amoeba. Less capacity, in fact, since it couldn't live by itself. But put the cells together and you have something that could invent a spaceship or write a symphony." "I get the idea," said Drake. Weiss went on. "All life on Saybrook's planet is a single organism. In a sense, all life on Earth is, too. But it's a fighting dependence, a dog-eat-dog dependence. The bacteria fix nitrogen, the plants fix carbon, animals eat plants and each other, bacterial decay hits everything. It comes full circle. Each grabs as much as it can and is, in turn, grabbed. On Saybrook's planet, each organism has its place, as each cell in our body does. Bacteria and plants produce food, on the excess of which animals feed, providing, in turn, carbon dioxide and nitrogenous wastes. Nothing is produced more or less than is needed. The scheme of life is intelligently altered to suit the local environment. No group of life forms multiplies more or less than is needed, just as the cells in our body stop multiplying when there are enough of them for a given purpose. When they don't stop multiplying, we call it cancer. And that's what life on Earth really is, the kind of organic organization we have compared to that on Saybrook's planet. One big cancer, every species, every individual doing its best to thrive at the expense of every other species and individual. You sound as if you approve of Saybrook's planet, Doc. I do, in a way. It makes sense out of the business of living. I can see their viewpoint toward us. Suppose one of the cells of your body could be conscious of the efficiency of the human body as compared with that of the cell itself, and could realize that this was only the result of the union of many cells into a higher whole. And then, suppose it became conscious of the existence of free-living cells with bare life and nothing more. It might feel a very strong desire to drag the poor thing into an organization. It might feel sorry for it, feel perhaps a sort of missionary spirit. The things on Saybrook's planet, or the thing, one should use the singular, feels just that, perhaps. And went ahead by bringing about virgin births, ain't I? I've got to go easy on that angle of it, post office regulations, you know. There's nothing ribald about it, Drake. For centuries we've been able to make the eggs of sea urchins, bees, frogs, etc., develop without the intervention of male fertilization. The touch of a needle was sometimes enough, or just immersion in the proper salt solution. The thing on Saybrook's planet can cause fertilization by the controlled use of radiant energy. That's why an appropriate energy barrier stops it. Interference, you see, they're static. They can do more than stimulate the division and development of an unfertilized egg. They can impress their own characteristics upon its nucleoproteins, so that the young are born with the little patches of green fur which serve as the planet's sense organ and means of communication. The young, in other words, are not individuals, but become part of the thing on Saybrook's planet. The thing on the planet, not at all, incidentally, can impregnate any species, plant, animal, or microscopic. Potent stuff, muttered Drake. Totipotent, Dr. Weiss said sharply. Universally potent. Any fragment of it is totipotent. Given time, a single bacterium from Saybrook's planet can convert all of Earth into a single organism. We've got the experimental proof of that, Drake said unexpectedly. You know, I think I'm a millionaire, Doc. Can you keep a secret? Weiss nodded, puzzled. I've got a souvenir from Saybrook's planet, Drake told him, grinning. It's only a pebble, but after the publicity the planet will get, combined with the fact that it's quarantined from here on in, the pebble will be all any human being will ever see of it. How much do you suppose I could sell the thing for? Weiss stared. A pebble? He snatched at the object shown him, a hard, gray ovoid. You shouldn't have done that, Drake. It was strictly against regulations, I know. That's why I asked if you could keep a secret. If you could give me a side note of authentication. What's the matter, Doc? Instead of answering, Weiss could only chatter and point. Drake ran over and stared down at the pebble. It was the same as before, except that the light was catching it at an angle and it showed up two little green spots. Look very closely. They were patches of green hairs. He was disturbed. There was a definite air of danger within the ship. There was the suspicion of his presence aboard. How could that be? He had done nothing yet. Had another fragment of home come aboard and been less cautious? That would be impossible without his knowledge. And though he probed the ship intensely, he found nothing. And then the suspicion diminished, but it was not quite dead. One of the keen thinkers still wondered and was treading close to the truth. How long before the landing? Would an entire world of life fragments be deprived of completeness? He clung closer to the severed ends of the wire he had been specially bred to imitate, afraid of detection, fearful for his altruistic mission. Dr. Weiss had locked himself in his own room. They were already within the solar system, and in 3 hours they would be landing. He had to think. He had 3 hours in which to decide. Drake's devilish pebble had been part of the organized life on Saybrook's planet, of course, but it was dead. It was dead when he had first seen it, and if it hadn't been, it was certainly dead after they fed it into the hyperatomic motor and converted it into a blast of pure heat. And the bacterial cultures still showed normal when Weiss anxiously checked. That was not what bothered Weiss now. Drake had picked up the pebble during the last hours of the stay on Saybrook's planet after the barrier breakdown. What if the breakdown had been the result of a slow, relentless mental pressure on the part of the thing on the planet? What if parts of its being waited to invade as the barrier dropped? If the pebble had not been fast enough and had moved only after the barrier was reestablished, it would have been killed. It would have lain there for Drake to see and pick up. It was a pebble, not a natural life form. But did that mean it was not some kind of life form? It might have been a deliberate production of the planet's single organism, a creature deliberately designed to look like a pebble, harmless-seeming, unsuspicious. Camouflage, in other words, a shrewd and frighteningly successful camouflage. Had any other camouflaged creature succeeded in crossing the barrier before it was reestablished? With a suitable shape filched from the minds of the humans aboard ship by the mind-reading organism of the planet? Would it have the casual appearance of a paperweight, of an ornamental brass-head nail in the captain's old-fashioned chair? And how would they locate it? Could they search every part of the ship for the telltale green patches, even down to individual microbes? And why camouflage? Did it intend to remain undetected for a time? Why? So that it might wait for the landing on Earth? An infection after landing could not be cured by blowing up a ship. The bacteria of Earth, the molds, yeasts, and protozoa would go first. Within a year, the non-human young would be arriving by the uncountable billions. Weiss closed his eyes and told himself it might not be such a bad thing. There would be no more disease, since no bacterium would multiply at the expense of its host, but instead would be satisfied with its fair share of what was available. There would be no more overpopulation. The hordes of mankind would decline to adjust themselves to the food supply. There would be no more wars, no crime, no greed. But there would be no more individuality either. Humanity would find security by becoming a cog in a biological machine. A man would be brother to a germ or to a liver cell. He stood up. He would have a talk with Captain Loring. They would send their report and blow up the ship, just as Saybrook had done. He sat down again. Saybrook had had proof, while he had only the conjectures of a terrorized mind rattled by the sight of two green spots on a pebble. Could he kill the 200 men on board ship because of a feeble suspicion? He had to think. He was straining. Why did he have to wait? If he could only welcome those who were aboard now, now! Yet a cooler, more reasoning part of himself told him that he could not. The little multipliers in the darkness would betray their new status in 15 minutes, and the keen thinkers had them under continual observation. Even 1 mile from the surface of their planet would be too soon, since they might still destroy themselves and their ship out in space. Better to wait for the main airlocks to open, for the planetary air to swirl in with millions of the little multipliers. Better to greet each one of them into the brotherhood of unified life and let them swirl out again to spread the message. Then it would be done. Another world organized, complete. He waited. There was the dull throbbing of the engines, working mightily to control the slow dropping of the ship, the shudder of contact with planetary surface. Then he let the jubilation of the keen thinkers sweep into reception, and his own jubilant thoughts answered them. Soon they would be able to receive as well as himself, perhaps not these particular fragments, but the fragments that would grow out of those which were fitted for the continuation of life. The main airlocks were about to be opened. And all thoughts ceased. Jerry Thorne thought, "Damn it, something's wrong now," he said to Captain Loring. "Sorry, there seems to be a power breakdown. The locks won't open." "Are you sure, Thorne? The lights are on." "Yes, sir. We're investigating it now." He tore away and joined Roger Olden at the airlock wiring box. "What's wrong?" "Give me a chance, will you?" Olden's hands were busy. Then he said, "For the love of Pete, there's a 6-inch break in the 20-amp lead." "What? That can't be." Olden held up the broken wires with their clean, sharp, sawn-through ends. Dr. Weiss joined them. He looked haggard, and there was the smell of brandy on his breath. He said shakily, "What's the matter?" They told him. At the bottom of the compartment, in one corner, was the missing section. Weiss bent over. There was a black fragment on the floor of the compartment. He touched it with his finger, and it smeared, leaving a sooty smudge on his fingertip. He rubbed it off absently. There might have been something taking the place of the missing section of wire, something that had been alive and only looked like wire, yet something that would heat, die, and carbonize in a tiny fraction of a second once the electrical circuit which controlled the airlock had been closed. He said, "How are the bacteria?" A crew member went to check, returned, and said, "All normal, Doc." The wires had meanwhile been spliced, the locks opened, and Dr. Weiss stepped out into the anarchic world of life that was Earth. "Anarchy," he said, laughing a little wildly. "And it will stay that way."